The Muslims will fight them, and they will be hiding themselves behind the trees and the rocks. Even the trees and the rocks, they hate the Jews. And the trees and the rocks would say, Ya Abdullah, O servant of Allah, come, there is a Jew behind me, kill him.
وطن غدت برجالها مسيوجة
مسيوجة
لهل العدا سم وطريق اللاوي ولهل الهدى واد وساع فجوجة مرقى براسه والشرف متساوي واسماؤهم
This is Radio Jihad. Radio Jihad.
Global Security Matters.
Good evening. It is Friday, August the 5th, 2011, at 6 o'clock Eastern Time. My name is Adrian Morgan. I'm the editor of Family Security Matters, and with me is my delectable co-host, Reese Cup, full of peanut butter goodness. Say hello, Reese.
Hello.
Oh, how's your week been?
Oh, hectic as always.
Right. anything, have you felt anything good or bad about these wonderful things going on about the debt crisis?
Well, it's one of those catch-22 things with the debt situation. You've got, you know, a lot of people up in arms about how some of the congressmen voted. I think everybody wanted everybody to just vote no against it. I'm the Tea Party type people, and
yeah.
And they're going to hold it against certain people, and I'm one of those people, you know, you can't always agree with a person or how they do things 100% of the time. You can't write somebody completely off over one or two issues. I think I'm blessed that I agree with my congressman approximately 82% of the time.
Right.
And that's pretty darn lucky. Most people, you're lucky if you get even 70% that you agree with the people. So,
yeah.
You know. You have to weigh your issues and decide for yourself what you're willing to stomach and not stomach, and not just be a one issue decision maker, because it's just not reality.
Yeah, I just think it's very, very depressing, the whole situation.
It is. You know,
I mean, the idea of putting a country into debt, not just for now. I just don't think presidents should be allowed to push debt into future generations and then try and make out that it's everybody else's fault. Talk of terrorists and hobbits are not helpful either, and Satan sandwiches. I mean, you know, the whole rhetoric gets away from what the real problems are. And as soon as the debt was agreed, all of a sudden stock markets, you know, Dow Jones was crashing, further and further down.
Yeah.
So
totally
it
down.
Certainly wasn't regarded as going to be good for America's future by the rest of the world. Putin was taking advantage of it as well. But that's going to affect things in the long term, I think, you know, especially when it comes down to issues of defense. It's going to certainly have an effect. How America deals with issues of terrorism is also going to be of great importance. Now, one thing that I want to discuss later in the show will be something that actually came up, that is, even Obama's supporters are now actually criticizing. And this is this amazing document. It's a PDF document. Later in the show, when I do discuss it, I will be providing a link to it. And it's been released this month, called Empowering Local Partners to Prevent Violent Extremism in the United States. And this is something which is basically trying to use community outreach work, which will mean getting involved with local mosques. And as we know, Obama and his cronies are very friendly with groups tied up with the Muslim Brotherhood. And it will be just the same pig's breakfast as has happened in Britain. We had a few years ago When it was a Labour government, we had this ridiculous woman, Jackie Smith. She was a person who's she charged on her expenses for her husband to watch gay porn movies and got the taxpayer to pay the bill. I mean, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, she was a ridiculous woman. And she set up this idea of they were going to have this wonderful idea of throwing huge amounts of taxpayers' money, £70 million, at groups who were going to be teaching people who might be radicalized into terrorism, that there was this wonderful, pure, authentic Islam. So what she was actually doing was giving money to all these groups that said, well, we're going to teach real Islam, which doesn't include terrorism, which doesn't include extremism, but also includes demands for Sharia and the destruction of democracy. And so you have £70 million worth, which in American terms, it's about $120 million of money, all from the taxpayer, which was then going to mosques and to community groups to prevent extremism by promoting the antithesis of democracy, which is Sharia law. And this is what is exactly is going to happen with one more of Obama's touchy-feely, ridiculous schemes to try and reach out and touch the Muslim world. We've got another thing that's coming in the news really now. It really was something that happened on July the 15th, when wondrous, happy, hugger-bunny, tree-loving Hillary Clinton decided to go and meet with the Organization of Islamic Conference and to help tell them that she would be supporting their moves to condemn anti-Semitism, but she was talking about anti-Semitism in Europe, not the anti-Semitism of the 57 members of the Organization of Islamic Conference, of course, most of whom are so anti-Israel, it seeps out around the edges, and anybody who is a Jew gets condemned. Notice at the beginning of the show, I have Sheikh Amri, who is from the United Arab Emirates. He's a respected imam calling for, he's talking about a quote from the Hadiths about at the end times, the Muslims will fight with the Jews, and the Jews will try and hide behind trees and rocks, and the Garkad tree, which is meant to be the tree of the Jews, will then cry out, come, there is a Jew behind me, come and kill him. This is actually written about in the Hamas Charter as well, and we've got talk coming up to September, which is only next month. There's going to be a vote in the United Nations about whether Palestine becomes a new nation. There never was a Palestine before. Palestine, as it was just another division in the Ottoman Empire, and then in the First World War, the Ottomans lost control of that region. The Balfour Declaration was saying they were going to make a Jewish state within there. Jews have been living in that region, have been moving to that region en masse since the middle of the 19th century. But basically, there is a huge amount of anti-Semitism within the Muslim world. Hillary Clinton didn't want to mention that. She wanted to pinpoint those nasty white European anti-Semites because it's easier, because then the Muslim world doesn't get made to confront its problems. And what she also, the most important aspect of what Hillary Clinton has been doing, is talking about the OIC's plan to introduce, through the United Nations human rights groups, this notion of making the defamation of Islam a crime. And the OIC are going to advise people on how they can implement this throughout the Muslim world and throughout the non-Muslim world. And Hillary Clinton is 100% behind this, she said. What a traitor to freedom of speech. In 1948, in December, there was a United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. This Declaration of Human Rights was accepted, signed by countries, including countries like Afghanistan. A lot of Muslim countries also signed it. But then, what happened in 1990, as a direct result of the Organization of Islamic Conference, on the 5th of August 1990, the member states of the Organization of the Islamic Conference all unilaterally dropped out from the agreements they had made in 1948 December, and they instituted the Cairo Declaration on Human Rights in Islam. And this basically superseded everything that was set up inside the 1948 Declaration of Human Rights. In the Declaration of Human Rights, Article 19, you're allowed to change your religion. The very last clause of the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights, let me just scroll down, I've got it in front of me now. Article 25. The Islamic Sharia is the only source of reference for the explanation or classification of any of the articles of this declaration. Basically, Islam rules, everything else is secondary. So rights of women in courts of law, a woman's rights will be less half that of a man. And this is half that of a Muslim man. A non-Muslim man would also have half the rights in a court of law. You'd have to get two non-Muslim men to testify against somebody in Islam in an Islamic court and have it have the same value as one Muslim man. Sharia, by its very nature, is discriminatory. And when people like Hillary Clinton go dancing around with the Organization for Islamic Conference, when they have absolutely no respect for human rights, let's just take a little look at the OIC briefly. The two major headquarters where they have their conferences, they alternate between these two different places. The one is in Saudi Arabia. The other is in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. In Saudi Arabia, you cannot practice any other religion. And in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, they became independent in 1949. So they never actually... there'd been Malaya before that, a British protectorate. They did not become independent until... they had their Merdeka, which was their independence in 1949, in June of that year, I believe it was June, maybe in August. And when they had that, they had quite some of the aspects of their constitution were quite good. They were saying everybody has freedom of worship and everything else like that. But what you have since the 1960s in Malaya, has been, under Mahathir Mohamad, has this been this policy of Ketuanan Melayu. Now, this Ketuanan Melayu means basically that people who are Malays, ethnic Malays, are superior to others, and they get rights. Now, in Malaysia, you have 60% of the population is Muslim. Most of those are Malays. You have a few Indians and Chinese. And the other 40%, they are either the Orang Asli, the original people, or you have the Hindus and the Chinese, you know, Indians and Chinese ethnic Buddhists who moved under British rule. They were brought in to work the fields and to build roads and things like that. Now, these people are discriminated against. They have no rights. They have housing preferences, always go to Muslims. In the Constitution, it says that all of the native people in Islam, in Malaya, who are Malays, are Islamic by nature. At the age of 12, everybody gets issued a MICAD, which is an identity card. You cannot change your religion. There's a woman called Lena Joy. Now, she, in 1989, she was born as a Malay Muslim. Her little identity card said that she was a Muslim. she became a Christian in 1989. And because in the 1990s, one of the constitutional laws was amended, which, so Article 121A says that anybody who has any issue to do, which falls under the jurisdiction of the Sharia courts, cannot take their cases or have them dealt with by the secular courts, you know, the High Court or the Federal Courts. Now, they have 13 states in Malaysia, and there are 13 major Islamic bodies, each one representing each different state. Now, Lena Joy, being a Christian, she's got a boyfriend, she has been trying, she's gone to the federal court, and all the way along they say, well, I'm sorry, because we've had this constitutional amendment, we can't change this. The National Registration Department, who issue these MyCAD cards, they don't allow her to change her religion because they say that she can only have her religion, which is listed as Muslim, changed if a Sharia court accepts it. And no Sharia court will allow her to change her religion. You know, I mean, I was chatting with Reese earlier. We mentioned about the Hotel California. You can check in and you can't check out. This is what Islam is. And because Lena Joy, now it's 2011, and she has a Christian boyfriend, she cannot marry him because, as a Muslim woman officially, she does not have the rights to marry a non-Muslim. A Muslim man can marry under Sharia law a Christian woman or a Jewish woman, but a Christian or Jewish man cannot marry a Muslim woman. And therefore, she's prevented from marrying for choice. This is what the two countries who are the prime movers within the Organization of Islamic Conference, this is what they are about. They don't give a rat's ass about human rights. The whole fact that they reneged on all of the agreements which people had signed in December 1948, the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the fact that they reneged all of that and then instituted their Cairo Declaration on Human Rights in Islam is worrying. And then for the last, it's been going on for about 6 years, within the United Nations Human Rights Commission, which these people don't respect because they've walked out on it, but unfortunately they've also put OIC, Organization of Islamic Conference members, into the United Nations Human Rights Commission, have been working and working towards getting a revision to the laws of the United Nations to make that every country should be implementing legislation to make the defamation of religion illegal. What that means is nothing to do about defamation of other religions, but the defamation of Islam. And that's all they are worried about. And the fact that the United Nations is doing that, and the fact that this stupid witch, Hillary Clinton, in her happy-clappy, let's go and hug a Muslim and make it all better, is playing this ridiculous game. This is something that the Democrats were doing long before Obama came onto the picture. In April 2007, we had the disgusting spectacle of Steny Hoyer, Majority Speaker of the House. He was in Egypt. April 7th, he was in Egypt, and he met with the senior parliamentary, a man called Khatatni, who then was the leader of the Egypt's parliamentary Muslim Brotherhood group. The Muslim Brotherhood under Mubarak were not allowed to become a political party because under the strained democracy that Hosni Mubarak, you know, presided over, he knew that they would, once in power, would remove democracy altogether and implement Sharia law and destroy democracy and make it a Sharia-compliant nation. There are many things that Hosni Mubarak did which were wrong. It's very sad to see him this week in a court in Cairo, in bed, in a hospital bed. He's lost pounds and pounds of weight with his illness. He can't stand up. And he's put in a cage like he's Jeffrey Dahmer or some serial killer. This is not what anybody believed. All of these liberal, libtard idiots from the New York Times who were going on about, oh, isn't it wonderful about how the Arab Spring is all happening. This is before the Logan woman, you know, ended up getting raped by these people. Now, this is a whole... I don't want to digress too far, but the Organization of Islamic Conference made their declaration in Cairo. You know, a lot of it is also being, you know, decided in places like Cairo and Istanbul. You know, as I said, there's 57 countries which are in this alliance of Islamic nations. And it's something that really we should be waking up to, that these movements within the OIC are very dangerous. Now, in April the 7th, 2007, Steny Hoyer met with this Khatatni guy who was head of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. 2 days before that, wonderful Nancy Pelosi was running around in a Damascus market with a hijab, a Muslim headscarf on her head, talking to al-Bashir, you know, to Assad, you know, Bashir Assad, the prime minister of Syria, even though they had been recommended by George W. Bush not to go. There was a little delegation of them. They thought this was the beginning of the appeasement to the Muslim Brotherhood. And this is why this document, which is now being discussed today, which has only just come out, this document, it's a very short document called Empowering Local Partners to Prevent Violent Extremism in the United States. It is so worrying. It is really, you know, and they start off by saying... sadly, the threat of violent extremism in America is nothing new. Throughout our history, misguided groups, including international and domestic terrorist organizations, neo-Nazis and anti-Semitic hate groups, have engaged in horrific violence to kill our citizens and threaten our way of life. Yeah, yeah, the neo-Nazis and anti-Semites. Yeah, those started off, you know, the best versions of those are the Ku Klux Klan. Who set those up? The Democratic Party, but let's not, you know, mince words. Let's have a little look at what they got in here. Protecting American communities from Al-Qaeda's hateful ideology is not the work of government alone. Communities, especially Muslim American communities whose children, families, and neighbors are being targeted for recruitment by Al-Qaeda, are often best positioned to take the lead because they know their communities best. Indeed, Muslim American communities have categorically condemned terrorism, worked with law enforcement to help prevent terrorist attacks, and forged creative programs to prevent their sons and daughters from Al-Qaeda's murderous ideology. And this crap goes on and on. It's this same mealy-mouthed, let's get the communities involved. It's exactly what happened with Britain with our prevent strategy, which went horribly wrong, and ended up with £1 million British pounds was being given to a Muslim Brotherhood group, which was also tied up with making threats against non-Muslims within the East End of London. And since Obama came into power, since he made his Cairo speech in June 2009, at Al-Azhar University in Cairo, which is Al-Azhar University, it's the largest Sunni Muslim center of learning in the world. The second largest after that is the Deobandi Institution. The Deobandi Institution has spawned the ideology which is behind all the leaders of the Taliban, you know, i.e. women, treat your women badly, wrap them up in tents, hit them, beat them, and everything will be hunky-dory and tickety-boo. And this current American administration, through stealth, has been trying to make links with the Muslim Brotherhood. You had Ingrid Mattson. She's the head of the Islamic Society of North America, ISNA, which is another Muslim Brotherhood front group. You've got Muslim Brotherhood front groups all over the place. And these are the people who are presenting themselves as the leaders of the communities. This is where it is very, very, very worrying, because the Muslim Brotherhood and other groups, I mean, for example, let's just list a few of the American ones just so that we, you know, don't have any problems. The Muslim American Society, the Muslim Students Association, that's one of the earliest ones. That was founded in 1963, the Muslim Students Society, Students Association, the MSA. The MAS, the Muslim American Society, that was founded, I think, in about 1980. You've got other groups. You've got the North American Islamic Trust, which is one of the co-conspirators in the Holy Land trial. You've got ISNA, I mentioned, the Islamic Society of North America. You've got the ICNA, the Islamic Circle of North America. Now, you've got these groups which are popping up, which then have a lot of people within them. They own mosques, they control mosques. For example, the Darul Hijra Mosque was set up, the one where Anwar al-Awlaki, at Falls Church in Virginia, where Anwar al-Awlaki used to be the imam before he fled after 9/11. That was set up by Muslim Brotherhood members. You've got the massive Roxbury Mosque in Boston. Now, that was set up by people on their trusts. The trustees, the original trustees, were including people like Yusuf al-Qaradawi. He's the senior. He's not actually officially a Muslim Brotherhood member. He is regarded as the spiritual advisor and spiritual leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. And you've also got people like Abdurrahman Al-Amoudi, who in 2003 was jailed for 23 years for taking Libyan money to try and kill then Prince Abdullah, who is now King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. He was given a 23-year jail sentence. Now you have members of the government, members of this Democrat administration under Obama, are now talking about reducing Al-Amoudi's jail sentence. What is going on? At about the time that Nancy Pelosi was making an absolute ass of herself by, you know, mincing around in the market with her little Muslim headscarf on and going, "Oh, we're all friendly with you. You may be communists, you know, but doesn't matter. We're your friends." And 2 days later, it was Steny Hoyer, you know, another Democrat senior politician, was in Egypt talking to Muslim Brotherhood members. At the same time, a month before that, the Nixon Center had published a document called the Moderate Muslim Brotherhood. Now, this was by Leakin and Brooks, two authors, who were basically maintaining their thesis was that if you have the threat of Al-Qaeda, then why not go to the next best thing? You deal with the Islamists who aren't going to blow you up. And isn't that hunky-dory, and isn't it great? What that actually means is, it's like Islamism, you're saying, is the only method of Islam that there is that you're going to negotiate with. So instead of negotiating with people who are going to threaten to blow you up, and have already, we're coming up to the 10th anniversary very soon of 9/11, it seems that this administration is trying to pretend that never happened. The idea of putting community leaders in charge is incredibly destructive. Once you start doing that, when those community leaders are basically positioned there by the Muslim Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood works to destroy democracy. And if you destroy democracy, you're not going to get anywhere. I mean, and also groups like CARE, again, Muslim Brotherhood front group. Now, this group, so everyone remembers that Omar Ahmed was talking about how, Islam is not in California. You know, he'd said to people, I think it was in 1998, Islam is not in America to be equal, it's to be dominant. Now, this Muslim Brotherhood Front, they have been active in all sorts of areas. They tried in the Supreme Court. You've got these various sculptures of lawgivers, you know, from Solon, the Greek lawgiver, and Moses. And in amongst these various figures in this bas-relief frieze around the room, you then have Muhammad with his sword and with his Quran. It was carved in the 1930s. It was intended to be an act of respect to show that Muhammad was a lawgiver and one of the world's major lawgivers. And one of the things that CARE started to do shortly after it was founded in the late 90s, it was then at that time going very much into trying to get permission to have this statue of Muhammad sandblasted out of existence. You know, they don't go small, they go right to the top. And this is what is now happening. It seems to be that this notion, this document called the Moderate Muslim Brotherhood by the Nixon Center, you can find it online, it's been reproduced by various sites. You don't have to get it just from the Nixon Center. It's called the Moderate Muslim Brotherhood. It's by Leeken, L-I-E-K-E-N, and Brooks, B-R-O-O-K-E-S. If you read that, the whole notion is that because the Muslim Brotherhood doesn't bomb people, that it should be dealt with. This is like a document of fatalism. This is like assuming that, well, you can't win, you know, against Islam because Islam's going to take over anyway. We might as well just make the people who are going to take over. We'll deal with the ones who are not going to blow us all up. That is nonsense. If you have this now, this new document released this week, this United States document, the one which is called Empowering Local Partners to Prevent Violent Extremism in the United States, from August the 2nd, it's only from 3 days ago that it was brought out. This document is basically saying that we in America and other places, you know, I'm not American, you know, but we have, as American people, as other people, have to got to not use government to control extremism, the communities. When you think about how the Muslim Brotherhood, groups like Hizb ut-Tahrir have taken over mosques, like ICNA. Now, ICNA is the Islamic Circle of North America. That is linked to two groups. It is linked to the Muslim Brotherhood. It is also linked to the Jamaat-e-Islami Party. Now, the Jamaat-e-Islami Party was founded by Sayyid Alamoududi. He died in Baltimore in 1979, but he was Indian-born. And what he did was set up this political party, and it was set up in India in about 1950. And it also had great importance in Bangladesh and great importance in Pakistan. When Bangladesh had its very bloodthirsty war for independence, in 1971, finally Bangladesh did get to be independent from Pakistan. 3 million people died. A lot of those were Hindus, and the Jamaat-e-Islami Party was behind a lot of the killings. Villages which wanted to have independence from West Pakistan, as it was then, the Jamaat-e-Islami Party were involved with getting young girls and from villages and giving them to the Pakistani soldiers to rape at will. And Motiur Nizami, who's head of the Bangladeshi Jamaat-e-Islami Party, he is reputed to have committed numerous war crimes. There is a man called Delwar Hossein Saeedi. He's another senior member. He's now going on trial for the first time. This is a man who's been invited to the East London Mosque in Britain on two occasions. And the East London Mosque is one of the places where Umar Farooq Abdulmuttalab, the underwear bomber, where he used to go and worship. Now, the head of this, the chairman of the mosque, is a man called Muhammad Abdul Bari, who is Bangladeshi, and who supports the Jamaat-e-Islami Party. And Delwar Hossein Saeedi, when he came to Britain, there were fights. His supporters were beating up other decent, peaceful Muslims. And Delwar Hossein Saeedi, one of the people who There was a massive bomb campaign in 2005 in Bangladesh, and there was a bigger one in 2004 for which he's now being he's being put on trial for being involved in that, where he tried to kill people who are now the current leaders of the government in Bangladesh. It's a very violent organization in Bangladesh, and the Jamaat-e-Islami party, that in India it's very small. Where it was originally founded. It's called the Jamaat-e-Islami Al-Hind, and that has a very small amount of people. But the Jamaat-e-Islami Party and the Muslim Brotherhood, in many Western countries, they work in cahoots with each other. In Pakistan, in 2006, the Jamaat-e-Islami Party tried to introduce into the National Assembly a law which would have meant that any apostate from Islam would end up being punished with the death penalty. This is the sort of people who Obama is expecting communities to be dealing with, because ICNA, the Islamic Circle of North America, as I said, is tied up with a Jamaat-e-Islami Party, which is based in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Has absolutely no respect for democracy. It uses democracy to get people into power to then destroy democracies. Its whole aim is, one, when you had the awful Pakistani laws, we had the things called the Hudud Ordinances. The Hudud Ordinances meant that Islamic Sharia law was introduced into Pakistan in from 1979 till about 1988, they had a dictator in Pastan called General Zia-ul-Haq, a military dictator. He worked with the Jamaat-e-Islami Party to bring in these awful blasphemy laws, where if you now, in 1990, those were revised so that if you insult the Prophet Muhammad, you can now have the death penalty. It's not actually happened yet, but a lot of people have been jailed. Under his regime, with the help of the Jamaat-e-Islami Party, they introduced drastic blasphemy laws where you can get life imprisonment for insulting Muhammad, for insulting his wife, or for desecrating a Quran, and also various other laws which are basically totally anti-democratic. And the worst of these was the Hudud Ordinances. The Hudud Ordinances were laws about illegal sexual intercourse. Now, if a woman had been raped, she couldn't go to a court and say, I have been raped, unless she could, under Sharia law, bring four male Muslim witnesses who had been seeing that she was raped by force. Now, most rapes, and in Pakistan, unfortunately, gang rape is used as a tactic to try to get Christians to convert. They get young Christian women. Some have been known. In 2005, there was a case of a 12-year-old girl who was gang raped to try and make her give up her faith and become a Muslim. And this whole notion of getting people to convert so that, really, when it comes to sort of people who've been raped, if they talk about this and they are Muslims, they will have, if they can't provide those four male Muslim witnesses, women were then being jailed because they had confessed to zina. Zina is illegal intercourse. So these Hudud Ordinances were introduced in order for General Zia-ul-Haq to have his control over the village regions where the Jamaat-e-Islami Party has some sort of strength. They introduced the blasphemy laws, and then they introduced these ridiculously dangerous Hudud Ordinances. And it was the Jamaat-e-Islami Party who were trying to resist these, even though lots of raped women were being put in jail merely for reporting that they had been raped. It's a total travesty of justice. And this is why I'm saying that, you know, things like Sharia law, you cannot expect the United Nations Commission of Human Rights to be dealing with anything that's going to support Sharia law. It doesn't respect the rights of women. certainly on the issue of, you know, a woman who's been raped. And not only that, if a woman couldn't produce four male Muslim witnesses under the Hudud ordinances and Sharia law, she could have provided eight females, you know, or eight non-Muslims. It's a ridiculous situation. It is not justice. People like to con themselves that Islam is fair. And when you get some ridiculous, useful idiot like Hillary Clinton trying to support the current motives of trying to change, the OIC is trying to change laws around the world, and they're getting pretty close to it now. They're getting support when they're getting support from the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. It is a very, very, very dangerous move. And this document, which has just come out about empowering local partners to prevent violent extremism. Who are these local partners? Are going to be so-called local leaders. I used to work in Hackney in London in the 80s. For all of these local leaders, these self-styled, jumped-up little despots who were conning taxpayers out of their monies, who did nothing for the communities, who just set themselves up as leaders. But with the Muslim Brotherhood, they have managed already to infiltrate and to set up mosques and to run mosques and to already have influence within the conservative movement as well. You know, we have got in Britain, in America, and every European and Western country, Australia and South Africa and other countries like that, we have got this huge problem ahead of us of how to deal with Islamism. And unfortunately, everything that had been worked on since 2001, after 9/11, in the last couple of years, this ridiculous administration, led by this ridiculous excuse for a president, somebody who's had no dealings with the military, and which is why he's such a appallingly bad military leader. He's meant to be the commander-in-chief. He doesn't know how to make a quick decision. He's basically hums and haws and thinks about things. He has been actively trying to make it seem that if America is pro-Muslim, he made some ridiculous comment at one of his iftar dinners last year saying that Islam has always been in America. Absolute nonsense. You know, it is really, I mean, okay, there have been a few slaves are brought over, but that isn't what he was referring to. He was referring to this Muslim book. I think it's the Golden Garden or something. It's a, it's one of these books which, a bit like the Gospel of Barnabas, you know, which doesn't really have much authenticity. It's a Muslim book which a lot of Muslim fanatics and Islamists have picked up to say, oh, it says that Muslims went out to America right at the very start of Islam. They went out to this other land. And then we've got, in Ireland, we've got the story of, you know, St. Brendan's voyage, you know, where he met whales and things and then came to these islands. And there have been cases of Vikings who've landed in Northeast America. But that, you know, Canada, basically, Newfoundland and places. But that doesn't mean that Islam really was at the beginning. But for President Obama to say Islam has always been in America since the beginning, for him to say to the head of NASA that it was important, the most important thing was to do Muslim outreach work to make Muslims feel better about their past, that isn't the duty of NASA. The duty of NASA is space exploration for political and commercial gain, potentially. You know, there might become a time when we will need to mine planets, you know, and basically that's what NASA, one part of what NASA should be about. The other part is pure science. It is not about making Muslims feel better about the fact that most of their countries are backwards. And most of their countries are backwards because they have Islamist laws. They don't have proper democracies. They don't have proper constitutions which protect human rights. And they're trying to then infect the rest of their world, the world, with their crappy, primitive, 7th century barbarism. And you've got idiots like Obama and idiots like Hillary Clinton who are going out and saying, let's all be idiots too. I don't want that. I don't want to live in a world where freedom of speech, and I look to America as the one place where you actually have freedom of speech and freedom of religion. It will be destroyed if you can't defame religion. In Ireland, they have in their constitution, when Eamon de Valera was helping to set up the independence of Ireland round about the time of the First World War, one of the constitutional statements within Ireland's constitution is that there shall be no defamation of religion. Now, that meant, at that time, Catholicism, because that was the main religion of Ireland. As a result of that, the OIC nations, they are also trying to introduce Sharia banking everywhere on the quiet, trying to introduce this stealth jihadism. A lot of the senior figures who are behind the implementation of Sharia banking have all set themselves up in Ireland. Khalid bin Mahfouz, the man who sued Rachel Ehrenfeld for her book Funding Evil, you know, which claimed that he had given money because Madeleine Albright had said after the two embassy bombings in Tanzania and Kenya in August 1998, Madeleine Albright, she's pretty much a liberal leftard, libtard, you know, individual, she had said that shortly after these bombings, Khalid bin Mahfouz had placed money himself into the accounts of people who had been involved with committing those bombings. All Rachel Ehrenfeld had done was repeat what Madeleine Albright had said in Congress, but she was protected. Rachel was then sued by this man. Now, he died in August 2009, so I can say what I say about him. He had set himself up in Ireland. And this idea of we have got a government which in it's only been in power for a few years. It was voted in November 2008. And it is basically destroying all of the good work that had been done to counter jihadism and to counter terrorism. The important thing is that Muslims should be allowed to live as Americans, which is great. But they should be treated as citizens and made to feel that they must obey the law. This is a government in America which is trying to introduce dream acts under what was Harry Reid was really behind that. I mean, the Nevada sort of, you know, guy who is again involved with trying to mess around with the debt ceiling. You know, you have some appalling people in your government at this current moment in time who are influential. And you have an appalling president, and you have an appalling cabinet. And what they are doing is taking everything that had been done after 9/11. Within months, within 2 months of 9/11 happening, banks, charities around the world which were supporting terrorism were made illegal. A massive amount of research was being done by the US Treasury Department. It was done by the FBI. It was done by the CIA. And all these different groups were researching the long tentacles of Islamism. What this particular administration, since, as I was saying at the start, from April 2007, when Steny Hoyer was in Egypt and when Nancy Pelosi was in Syria, and these weren't the only ones, and there were some Republicans too, who against the better judgment of the George W. Bush administration, who again made their own little groups, fact-finding missions, as they called them, out to then go and liaise with these people who had Muslim Brotherhood members within their countries and trying to talk to them about how they could make things change. This idea of the Arab Spring going to be this wonderful rebirth of democracy, I don't think it's going to happen. We're seeing already in Egypt with Hosni Mubarak in a court case, lying prone on his back in a hospital bed behind a cage. Okay, he may have been a dictator, but he wasn't a dictator like Saddam Hussein. He wasn't killing people. He jailed bloggers. You know, he was a repressive individual. But he was no more repressive than what the current people who are trying to try him are trying to make out of Egypt. When eventually, and it's almost a certainty, that the Islamists of the Muslim Brotherhood are going to have an extreme fortuitous position in whatever government that gets formed. They're coming up to elections here, and the Islamists are going to have decisive powers. They are going to be far, far more repressive than Hosni Mubarak ever was. Now, I have been ranting solidly for 50 minutes. I haven't made myself a cup of tea. So, I am now going to play a little bit of music. This is some cheery music. I've got somebody who's just listening as well. I'm going to let them come in and talk to me when I come back. I am just going to put on some music, and if I can find it, a very short little musical break, just so I can put my kettle on and have some tea to drink. It's not appearing easily now in my list of... Right, here it is. This is called Alligator Crawl. It's by Fats Waller. Enjoy. It's something upbeat and cheery. I love Fats Waller. Oops, sorry. Ignore the background noises. I've got Mohammed the Monkey, just in case, you know, any callers are going to give us any problems. Now, I have a caller on the line now. Hello, I'm going to bring you... I'm sorry, I didn't see you there. You're apparently saying you're just listening, so I'm going to bring you in. Hello, caller. Can you hear me? Hello? I can't hear anything. I tell you what, if you hang up and then try again, I will keep my eye out on the switchboard, and so I'll pick up anything that, you know, comes in. So, as I can't hear a word you're saying, I'm just hearing white noise. And the sound of my kettle as well. Nope, I can't hear you. I'm really sorry. What I'm going to do is I'm going to hang up this call. And if you can call back, hopefully I will be able to pick you up then. I'm really sorry. Okay, well, yeah, that's a shame. Please, caller, try again. I've got my eyes on the switchboard, and I just had a little look in the chat. Nice to see so many people in there tonight, and there's not a single guest. They've all got names for a change, which is brilliant. And, right, okay, thanks, Morty. Yes, that breakdown of the manifesto. There's another little aspect, which might be controversial to... Yeah, white noise, is that like... No, Holger, it is not like cracker noise. No, we won't talk about that. Sorry. Right. Yes, now there was another aspect which has come out in the news now, which I think is a real shame it hasn't been made more available. One thing that I'm quite surprised about is that when you had all of those people being killed by Anders Behring Breivik on the 22nd of July, the Friday, 2 weeks ago, there were... Initially, it was thought that 92 people had been killed, and eventually it was downgraded to only 75, then one of the wounded died, and it came up to 76. One of the reasons why they'd had problems with the accounting of how many people there were was due to a heroic lesbian couple called Hege Dahlen and Toril Hansen. Now, these were two women who were having a holiday on the shore, and they heard the gunfire, and they got in their boat. Now, if I hear gunfire, I would be running in the opposite direction as fast as possible. So these women have more balls than I do. So they got in their boat, and they went out and they rescued 40 young people from the lake, because it was three quarters of a mile from Utoya Lake to the shore. And their boat ended up with bullet holes in it, so they were right in the crossfire. Anders Behring Breivik could see what they were doing and fired at them. And they saved 40 people's lives. And so I'm amazed that this has been so downplayed. I mean, in Europe, we don't seem to have much of a problem if people are lesbian, you know, big deal. But it seems in America, for some people, it does. But to Hege Dahlen and Toril Hansen, they saved 40 people's lives that day. And that should be, you know, whether they're lesbian or not is irrelevant. But the fact that two women went and saved 40 young people's lives while the police and... the so-called anti-terror forces in Norway could not even get it together to do that themselves. That is something quite amazing, I think. You know, that two women, in the face of gunfire, with no arms whatsoever, went out and rescued 40 people. So, good luck to them. And it also must sort of, I don't know... I've read the 1,518 pages of his manifesto, you know, and so... I don't know, but basically I don't want to go and revisit that manifesto again, because it was really the work of a vainglorious psychopath. But weird stuff has happened also as a result of that, that I'd mentioned last week that this little weasel called Paul Ray, Acre Luton Lionheart, who says that he was a co-founder of the English Defence League, he was claiming that he was the mentor, this hypothetical character called Richard the Lionheart, who had been a mentor to Anders Behring Breivik. He went to the Times last Friday and the also the evening London Evening Standard. At the moment, because people can't, in the media, journalists, they can't use the bugging of people, they can't phone hack anymore, because it's suddenly become very bad. And the good part about that is that that wretched, evil swine, Piers Morgan, the noose is getting tighter around him, because apparently he was aware of a phone conversation between that awful woman, Heather Mills, and her then-husband, Paul McCartney. And now Paul McCartney's getting very angry and wanting explanations. it seems that Piers Morgan has got more explaining to do. And hopefully the outcome... I hate Piers Morgan. I hate him with a vengeance. I would really love to know that he has his CNN show dropped. He's a vile man. Okay, stop ranting. I hate Piers Morgan. I don't like Paul Ray either. But the weirdest thing about all of this is that, as I was saying last week, Paul Ray is trying to claim that he was an influential factor, which is, I think, really sick, taking the deaths of 76 people. 68 of those were from one island who were all shot, and then when they were pleading for mercy, they were shot in the heads, and then the people who were trying to lie down and pretend to be dead, he was going around and just shooting them in the back of the head anyway to make sure that they were dead. When you have sort of an individual trying to then claim credit for influencing someone, it's a very sick person. But one of the things that has happened, because in the 1,518-page manifesto of Anders Behring Breivik, it is now coming out that basically Fjordman, now Fjordman was one of the people who was most quoted, he has now outed himself. He did an interview, apparently, and according to the Wikipedia page, he's now known as Peder Ari Nostgaard Jensen, or Jensen, aged 36. And this is quite unbelievable. You know, Fjordman has been a figure, very well known. I mean, back in, I just went and looked back at his blog, which is still up. On Wednesday, December the 21st, 2005, he wrote on his blog that he was going to be closing his blog down, but carry on writing for occasionally posting comments at Little Green Footballs or Jihad Watch. And he wrote, every now and then, when I have the time and want to write about some topic, this will be posted at other blogs such as the Gates of Vienna and offered to Faith Freedom International and the Brussels Journal. And then he provides a list to most of his published essays. And then he goes on to say, in addition to these blogs and websites, which should all be known to most of my readers, you can follow my blog roll to find more blogs and news. Western Resistance should be read every day, as should... Then he goes and lists other things. Western Resistance at that time was the main writer for it. So sort of, I feel a bit sort of... He once on a forum called me a ridiculous PC fascist, because I was, complaining about, you've got to give people human rights. But it just seems a tragedy that, what is happening now is it seems that the left in the media, in America and in Europe, they've got hold of this whole issue, and they're trying to decimate the people who are conservative. And I don't mean conservative like that wretched little milksop David Cameron, of the Conservative Party, the Tories in Britain. I mean, he, just last Monday, not this one passed, but, the one that was 13 days ago, he was saying that he wanted an inquiry, straight after the attacks in Oslo and on Utøya Island. He was saying that we've got to have this massive investigation to see if there's any right-wingers who are going to be blowing up people. And obviously that meant a lot of paranoia. And then in that paranoia, people started, what was happening with Paul Ray, he was naming names of people that he didn't like and saying that they were to blame. It's got to a really very bad situation. And then someone like Fjordan, who had the privilege of anonymity, all of a sudden now his name, he's been forced, he's gone on to, done an interview, and he's given his name out. It's very disturbing that, because once you actually go out and you write under your own name, it's very, you end up getting vilified. I've been accused of all sorts of things, being a neo-fascist and things like that, and I used to be an anti-racist sort of activist, for two decades in London. I'm totally opposed to racism. I believe in women's rights and things like that. I believe in ethnic minorities. I believe in the rights of people to believe in Islam, even though I think Islam's a bullcrap ideology. It's still a person's right to believe in bullcrap if they want to. What the problem is when people start to use that bullcrap ideology to then subvert the societies they are living in, trying to introduce by the back door, as we have in Britain already, Sharia law has been introduced for negotiation for weddings and divorces and inheritance issues. And what I think is really going to be a problem, I mean, is just this whole notion of we've got people living in a country who are deciding that another alien set of values is something which is going to supersede the values of the country they're in. In a society, a democratic society, everybody must follow the law, and the laws can be changed, you know. And I find that this whole notion that Obama is now trying to introduce of trying to get people to have their community leaders as then taking over the job of acting as representatives to try and stop people from becoming extreme. This is something, people should be extreme anyway, and if there's any hint of a mosque going that way, the full force of the law should be brought down. Unfortunately, people like Ingrid Mattson has been campaigning in the past that people shouldn't cooperate with the FBI. Just at the end of last year, in November, she was saying that, you know, she's the woman who heads the Islamic Society of North America, you know, a Muslim Brotherhood front group in the States, saying that, you know, we don't cooperate with the FBI because they're into surveillance and, you know, we can't, they're getting more information than what they really need. You had CARE in California were publishing posters saying to Muslims not to cooperate. In 2006, in Scotland, in Clydeside, we had a member of the Muslim Association of Britain, a man called Osama Sayyid, he's a leading Muslim Brotherhood figure, was telling people, Muslim communities, don't cooperate with the police. What sort of message is this? You know, the idea is you don't cooperate with the police unless they give you concessions. And we've had groups in Britain, for example, in 2006, there was about 150 different organizations, of which almost half of them were tied up with the Muslim Brotherhood, made to the major newspapers, the Times, Guardian, other newspapers. This four-page adverts were put out where they were saying that because of Britain's foreign policy, that is why there's the risk of terrorism. And if Britain changed its foreign policy, i.e. moved out of Iraq, moved out of Afghanistan, then there wouldn't be any terrorism. And, you know, this is the way of blackmailing. And then what happened? There was a man called Pasha, who later in the same year was saying that he was one of the people who co-signed this advert, was saying to the British government, I will cooperate with you if you cooperate with us and give us Sharia law. It's this horse trading. When you have a democracy and the rule of law created by democratically elected people, even if those democratically elected people are bozos, like the people in the current administration in America, and the people who have been leading Britain for the last 20 years, all bozos, every man, woman, and, you know, senile, demented old dodderer amongst them. They are all bozos, it seems. Very few people have integrity. They just follow the party line. They're either in it for the cash or they're just going along with the parties. And I was going to say the crackers and the toast, but it seems our caller hasn't come back. I feel really sorry about that. I really hope that if there is anyone who wants to call in and have a chat, I will be perfectly willing to talk on any subject you want to talk about. And if it's a subject that I'm out of my depth with, I will have to admit. But it just seems very strange that things, I mean, other revelations, the Swedish intelligence people have been saying that Anders Behring Breivik was actually born in Britain. Both of his parents were Norwegian, but his father divorced his mother. His father was a diplomat. His father divorced his mother. She took young Anders Behring Breivik back to Oslo, where he lived in an equivalent of a project, I suppose. You know, the American equivalent would be a project. Communal housing, where local government authorities, you know, pay for these things. And he was apparently a bit of a mother's boy. And they were also saying that they think that he had cosmetic surgery. Whether he has or not, I'm not sure. But they were saying that the look of his face, they believe, was cosmetically enhanced to make him look like an Aryan poster child. Whether that's true or if it's just something that they were saying to the press or assuming, there has been no confirmation of that. What is interesting is that in one of his first days of being interrogated, during last week, not this current week, it was stated that at one stage he told his interrogators that he wanted to take over the Norwegian army. So at one level, he's a total fruitcake. I mean, he's, as we say in Britain, you know, he's madder than a box of frogs. But he has been influential, and now we have all of these groups, the Organization of Islamic Conference, who I was talking about in the first section of the show. They also are trying to manipulate this situation to say, well, you know, governments have now got to be on the lookout throughout the West, because there's going to be non-Muslim terrorism. There might be the odd few people. In Britain, we had one man who blew up three different venues and killed a few people and maimed several more, who was a lone, he'd been a former British National Party member, you know, which is a racist group, and then he went and attacked, it was a gay pub, and he attacked a Brick Lane. He set off a bomb there. Fortunately, nobody got killed, which is a very Muslim area of East London. And he was going to attack a Jewish group as well, but never got the chance to get round to do that. We do have the occasional lone wolf people, but the idea of trying to compare because of one incident with one very deranged individual to then say that anybody who's conservative, anybody who's critical of Islam, must suddenly also then come into the crosshairs and of the intelligence services as enemies, potential enemies of the state. You know, it's getting to be a bit ridiculous, the discourse, because of one incident of terrorism. How many other incidents of terrorism? You know, 18,000 since 2011 of terrorism incidents around the world, where people have died. You know, we've got to really start thinking very seriously about how we are being manipulated by the leftist media and their friends who are Islamists, and really see how when an individual like Fjordman can be forced to be outed with his real identity, his life's never going to be the same again from there. He's not going to be able to write his articles because he's now going to have to sort of be justifying everything else he's written. I'm not saying that, you know, I agree with everything he says. I think in some ways he's a bit more extreme than my position would be. But he has a right to be able to write. But then again, because he's now being vilified in the press, made out to be the person who influenced Anders Behring Breivik, you know, this is, you know, the idea of the press are trying to bring this cause and effect, this idea of if you criticize Islam, which has already had a mission since 632 AD, well, you know, after Muhammad died, to be spread around the world by the sword, to invade countries. I mean, the whole of European history has all been about battling against the encroachments of Islam. And in the Islamic world itself, you know, there have been, you know, the time of Tamerlane, and, you know, you had all this sort of wars against other groups. The Ottoman Empire was coming up, and Tamerlane the Great, who was born in Uzbekistan, was then fighting against the Ottomans. This is all at the end, just after the in the 14th century. The last crusade, the Ninth Crusade, took place in 1275, I believe. And after that, shortly after that, the last sort of Byzantine, under the Palaiologos dynasty, you had Manuel Palaiologos, who I don't know if you remember, you had the Regensburg speech of the 12th of September 2006, where the Pope quoted Manuel Palaiologos, who was the last but one of the Byzantine emperors before the Ottomans took them over. And he was a Christian, and he was saying, you know, tell me what Islam has brought to the world, you know, other than death and destruction. And when the Pope quoted that, all these Muslims around the world were then threatening death and destruction, you know, around the world. They can't. There's no sense of irony for Muslim protesters. You know, it's like Rage Boy, you know, it's always, you know, venting his rage and his anger about things. But, you know, when people get killed in demonstrations, you know, when people put, like, you know, Kurt Vestergaard puts a picture of Muhammad with a bomb on his turban to suggest that Muhammad was the initial architect of Islam's violent rampages against the rest of the world and against his own people, then all of these people are threatening to kill him, you know, proving his point. You know, they don't seem to realize that once you start threatening people with death for insulting their religion, you are part of a mindset of murder and danger, and people must stand up to it. I mean, I'm aware that I know that I'm under surveillance. I know this for a certain fact. This is going back last summer, I was sitting in a field with my laptop. I was in a Christian retreat. I was in the grounds, and there was a public footpath went through it, so I was sitting there, and I was talking to Gary Johnson, the person who phoned me last week, and on the show, and I was talking with him, and we were talking about the history of Al-Qaeda and about how Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, how it had set itself up from different groups, and we were discussing this. Where I am, it's not far from a government listening post. I don't want to say too much or too many details about that. And next thing I knew, a policeman just walked into this field. We were miles from anywhere. You know, I was just on my own in this field talking. There wasn't, you know, there was no direct road nearby. And he just walked into this field and then came up and then started asking me questions about, you know, I had my camera equipment, you know, what was I photographing? And then he made the strangest comment of all, asking me, he said to me, he didn't ask my name or anything, and he said, do you do paintings from your photographs? Or do you do your paintings from these photographs? And I thought, what a weird question. I then approached a friend of mine who was a professional photographer for 30 years, and I said, have you ever been asked, do you ever do paintings from your photographs? And he said, no. And I thought, why had this policeman asked me that? It was almost like saying, we know who you are. And because of this government listening post being nearby, whenever I go near it with my cameras, I always get stopped and, you know, questioned by their security people. I start to wonder, you know, I'm pretty certain I am under some form of surveillance because of my criticism of Islam. When I had a problem with a cyber stalker. There was a woman on a forum who suggested I was a BNP member, and I told her she was a whore of Satan, which perhaps was a bit sexist, it wasn't very nice, and I had for a year, she set up a stalking campaign, trying to get my address out on Islamist websites, trying to get me killed, and I went to the police about it. I had a policeman come round to my house, and he looked at my computer and saw that I was writing at that time for the Western Resistance blog, and he said, resistance? Resistance against what? I said, well, against Islamism. And he said, oh, really? Well, he said to me, these were his actual words. He said, you know, I've come here to examine a case which, you know, where you are being made a victim. And I said, I hope I don't go away from here having to then make you the subject of an investigation. And I thought, what the hell? You know, I've never advocated any violence against Muslims. I've never advocated any hate at all against Muslims. All I have said is I don't approve of Islam's ideology. I don't want it to have any effect upon my life. If people want to believe in bullcrap, that's totally their right. But I do not want to see governments, which are meant to be democratic, bypassing democracy and introducing things like Sharia law. And I don't want to see extremist preachers who are part of the Muslim Brotherhood or think that their hatred of Israel entitles them to talk about death and jihad. You know, I got a bit distracted earlier on when I mentioned Yusuf al-Qaradawi. You know, he was one of the trustees of the Roxbury Mosque in Boston. Similarly, so was Abdurrahman al-Amoudi. You know, these were people who are extremists, and they're from the Muslim Brotherhood. And Yusuf al-Qaradawi was invited to London by the London mayor, Ken Livingstone, a leftist. And this man was invited to London. He said it's perfectly all right to throw homosexuals off cliffs. It's perfectly all right to kill Israeli civilians. You know, he's not a desirable character. He's somebody who supports killing of people. He supports the killing of civilians. He also has himself every week on the Arabic version of the Al Jazeera TV station, which is based in Qatar, where he lives. He gives speeches. Now, in Britain, we have been funding him. We flew him in 2006 from his home in Cairo to a in Qatar, flew him to Istanbul in Turkey, put him up at a top-class hotel with his wife so he could attend an Islamic conference, and then paid for him to go and be flown back to Qatar. And he appears every week on Al Jazeera, Arabic version, based in Qatar, talking about how he hates the Jews, and he's an absolute bigot. He's a revolting specimen of human being. But what the hell? Obama was suggesting not so long back that Al Jazeera should be encouraged to appear on cable TV stations. Why would Obama do that? And then, lo and behold, in New York now, you got your cable systems in New York, you'll be able to listen to Al Jazeera, the English version, where they tell you only so much of the story. They don't have Al-Qaradawi on there. They just tell you that Islam's great, and they'll give you lots of information about how these poor Muslim Brotherhood members are being really oppressed in Egypt, and isn't it really, really terrible? They won't tell you the truth. It'll all be propaganda. And unfortunately, this is the world that we are living in at the moment. We're living in a world where people who are elected to serve their country, to lead their country, to uphold the Constitution, then you have your American President Obama, then tries to undermine it. You have this cartoon series called The 99, based on the 99 names of Allah, and he has openly supported it and said that it's a really good thing that everybody should see. I'm sorry, it is not the duty. There is something in the First Amendment of your Bill of Rights about there shall be no establishment of religion. But your president seems to do it. Every single time there's an issue of Islam, he will then want to promote Islam. I don't know what it is about this man, but he is an enemy of everything that the Founding Fathers set up. Maybe because one or two of them, like Jefferson, even though he was having sex with Sally Hemming, you know, and George Washington, they had slaves. Maybe he's feeling that he's doing his bit for reparation to try to uphold this notion of trying to restore justice, you know, after the event. But that wasn't what people elected him in for. They elected him in to lead the country, to make things better, you know, hope. What hope is there now? You're going to be in debt for, like, years to come. Your military is going to shrink. America's reputation is already dwindling because of this stupid, college-educated, leftist fart who has got absolutely no clue. He was dragged around the world by his wretched mother, went off to Indonesia and thought everything was all great. But even though at that time it was under Suharto, under a military dictatorship, so no wonder it was all nice and peaceful, because people were too scared to step out of line. You know, and then he goes back to, he went back in 2010 to Indonesia and came out with all these lovely statements about how great it was, not realizing that, for example, in Indonesia, you had in February members of the Ahmadiyya sect were savagely beaten. They were stripped naked. This was in Western Java. They were stripped naked and they were beaten with canes until they were killed. Three people died. Policemen stood by and did nothing. People then photographed this with their mobile phones while people were still carrying on, even after the bodies were dead. They were still being hit with these like bamboo canes until the canes broke. This is in February this year. Now, 2 years ago, the government of the current government was still in power then, and it had introduced a law which meant that the Ahmadiyya sect of Islam could not promote themselves. This is one of the other things which General Zia ul-Haq had introduced in the 1970s. You know, one of the blasphemy laws is that no member of the Qadiani, you know, group, or the Lahore group, it was also called, which is the name they gave to the Ahmadis. These were the followers of a man called Ghulam Ahmad. They believed that he was a prophet of Islam. Now, the Ahmadis, to become an Ahmadi Muslim, you have to make a statement that says that you vow to harm no one, which is quite unique amongst, you know, Islamic sects. These people have been persecuted and persecuted. And then about 2 or 3 years ago in Indonesia, the government said that these people cannot in Indonesia call themselves Muslims and they cannot promote themselves as Muslims. Exactly what has happened in Pakistan's laws. And Ahmadis, if Ahmadis get buried in a Muslim cemetery in Pakistan, they get dug up and forced to go to a different cemetery. People won't give them burial services. And people can be jailed for 3 years for proselytizing for their faith. This is what the Organization of Islamic Conference, this is how their idea of religious, they want to stop religious defamation and they want to talk about Islamic rights. This means that anybody who is regarded as a heretic, the Ahmadis cannot go to Saudi Arabia, they cannot go on the Hajj, the pilgrimage, because they're regarded as heretics. They followed this man who was alive at the end of the 19th century called Ghulam Ahmad, which is why they're called Ahmadis or Ahmadiyya, various spellings. And these people have been persecuted. And as I said, these massive beatings took place, a lot of it encouraged because now the government has outlawed the Ahmadiyyas from calling themselves Muslims, being allowed to be treated like normal people. And just last week, they had three people were sentenced. Not one of them got more than a three-month sentence. No one was convicted of killing. You know, after murdering these people in the most barbaric fashions, when you've got 20 or 30 people attacking three individuals and beating them to death, that is cowardly. These aspects of Islam, these are disgusting aspects of Islam, and they are encouraged by laws which prevent people having freedom of religion and the ability to have a pluralistic society where you can choose whatever you want to have. I'm getting a little bit, you know, annoyed and angry, so I am going to now play a slightly sleazy record from Georgia White called Hot Nuts. If I can play it. Little break. It's not playing.
Anybody here wanna buy my nuts? Selling nuts, hot nuts. I've got nuts for sale. 1 for $5, 2 for $10. If you buy them once, you buy them again. Selling nuts, hot nuts. You buy them from the peanut man. Selling nuts, hot nuts. Anybody here wanna buy my nuts? your nuts is mighty fine, but I bet your nuts ain't as hard as my selling nuts. All hot nuts, you buy 'em from the peanut man. Selling nuts, hot nuts. Anybody here wanna buy my nuts? Selling nuts, hot nuts. You buy 'em from the peanut man. They say your nuts is mighty small. Better have small nuts than none at all. Selling nuts, hot nuts. You buy 'em from the peanut man.
Half an hour left of the show. For some reason, I've managed to keep going for an hour and a half with very few notes, and I hope I'm not being too boring. But basically, there is so much that we really do need to address, particularly now after this idea of the Norway killings. And really, this has been a field day for the Islamists and the leftists to say, see, look, the other side do bombings too, so that you've got no excuse. Unfortunately, one lone psychopath, quoting from people like Andrew Bostrom. Now, Andrew Bostrom is one of the most academic writers on Islam. I mean, he is a doctor. You don't mess with Andrew Bostrom because he doesn't suffer fools gladly. He does his research. I mean, anybody should really read his books, you know, The Legacy of Islamic Jihad or The Legacy of Islamic Anti-Semitism. Absolutely phenomenal source works that, you know, you just cannot argue with anything inside them because they are so accurate. Now, he was one of the people quoted by Anders Behring Breivik. I don't always agree with all of Fjordman's, you know, conclusions. You know, but he has a right to make them. He has never called for the death or destructions of Muslims. I think the problem I find with someone like Fjordman is that he comes from a culture which traditionally didn't have immigration for a long time. And all of a sudden, when he was very small, it suddenly started. So it was something that, you know, he would have seen suddenly happening. You know, Norway has not been a colonial country like, say, Britain has. And I was brought up, and I'm ancient. I'm very, very old. And I was brought up in the 1960s. And in that time, I used to believe in being part of the British Commonwealth. That, you know, Britain was part of this great big family of all the countries where it had gone out and visited. I was totally naive. I believed what my teachers were telling me. And so I, you know, was quite happy with the idea of, you know, having sort of friends of different sort of ethnic backgrounds and things like that. And I think for Fjordman, I think that he sees that the groups who've arrived haven't got any linkages with the country. You know, at least one could see in India and in Jamaican people and West Indians, you know, that they had all been educated, a lot of them under an English-style sort of education, but A lot of them spoke the same language. What has happened in recent years has been so much migration from Muslim countries, which in 1997, it was May the 27th, 1997, the Labour Party under Tony Blair got into power and started after that this campaign of mass immigration in the hope, and not immigration from countries which Britain had had previous links with. And these people coming into the country didn't speak English. A lot of them didn't want to speak English. And the government was doing it because it automatically assumed, very patronizing, that all migrants are going to be supporting Labour socialist type groups because they will say that they will help people find jobs and homes and housing. Even if they're not working, they can still find houses. And they can bring their families over. And I think that's partly why Fjordman is quite harsh on migration and immigration, because he's seen it as destroying the fabric of his culture. Now, if somebody starts talking about that, then they get labelled as being racist, whereas, you know, Muslim countries get very annoyed when people start migrating in. We have this real sort of disconnect between, you know, what is really happening and how people spin things. And unfortunately, the left have had a field day since July the 22nd, when Anders Behring Breivik set off a car bomb in the political district of Oslo and then went off and started shooting young leftist members of a holiday camp, on a political holiday camp in an island in a fjord lake not far from Oslo, and killing in a total, in both attacks, killing a total of about 76 people. Now, this whole incident is one particular incident that's happened, and it's caused a lot of... I went on to the Faith Freedom Forum, which is, you know, another place where Fjordman used to be a member of, and I had a little look at the comments which were going on there, and a lot of people were agonizing, you know. Do we know this individual? Has he been there? You know, maybe he has, maybe he hasn't. But the thing is that people are scared to think, well, maybe I'm tied up with some sort of responsibility for this. And, you know, maybe some Muslims must have felt that way after 9/11. Maybe some Muslims must have felt that way after other attacks. That, you know, maybe my religion perhaps is... perhaps responsible. And we know for certain, I mean, one of the last things that Muhammad is reported to have said on, you know, towards his death is to have said, I have been made victorious through terror. This is in one of the hadiths of Bukhari. Now, I mean, there are always these problems. If you start quoting from a translation, then you're always going to get somebody coming and saying, oh, but you don't know the authentic Arabic, you know. And if you don't know the authentic Arabic, then, you know, is it can mean whatever we choose to say it means, and whatever you say it means, we can choose to refute you. We can get into all those arguments, but basically, you know, there is, it's obvious that Islam has had a negative influence. After, oh, call me mom, it's in the queue. Oh, I've just had a little, I'm so sorry. Yes, I'm going to talk to you, call me mom. Yes, I'm so sorry. Have you been waiting long?
Not too long.
I'm so sorry. It's so rude of me. You've been there 3 minutes. I'm so sorry. How are you?
I'm all right. And how are you?
Ah, I'm okay. I had a wonderful day today. I went out to Worcestershire and took my camera, took lots of infrared shots of beautiful sunshine. Yeah, I put them all on Facebook, so you can have a little look later if you want. They're brilliant photos, I say modestly. So, yes.
Okay. I was listening to you, and I think that you hit the nail on the head for a lot of the challenges we're facing right now, is that people are looking at, you know, Fjordman's, where he used to post, and saying, are we in some small way responsible for this?
Mm. And I think it's a good thing to do.
It is, but I think that that's part of the problem that the PC culture we're in, and especially over here in the States and in the school system especially,
right?
The idea that you might be responsible for something is held up as such a negative thing, whereas leadership requires that you take responsibility, which is why we have such a crisis of leadership, because the idea that you might be responsible for something is so horrible to most people now.
Yeah, and it also depends very much of who is expected to take responsibility. It's like if you can claim, like Palestinians, that they have been oppressed, then they're justified to go and have their Hamas charter and to go and commit horrific crimes. You know, when they had the talks last year in the fall, when you had the discussions going on in the White House. And then you had four people killed in Hebron, you know, by Hamas, you know, this group, which is, you know, and it's all, oh, that's okay because they're oppressed and these were settlers who were invaded. You know, there is this very, very sickening way of, if you remember, you know, I mean, we've had it in Britain for years as well, you know, it's sort of, there used to be a dogma. I was saying I used to work a lot with anti-racial problems, you know, and, you know, I used to work for sort of, you know, Hackney Council for Racial Equality and all these Hackney Action for Racial Equality and all these different little groups. I was just acting, mainly doing annual reports and design work and posters for these people. But it was always, it was one thing that came out in the middle 80s of, it was a dogma going around that only white people can be racist. It was this idea that, you know, racism was all about power. And it's almost like a lot of the politically correct people at the moment, they're engaging in some form of reparation for the damages that, you know, other people's ancestors have done. And it's this ancestral, it's like a blood libel. It's like, you know, I mean, I know for certain, I mean, my ancestors, at least on the male side of my family, were here in Britain before the Romans. And I can guarantee that my ancestors weren't the ruling classes because we were Welsh. And we were oppressed. My father didn't learn English until he was seven, until he learned it as a school subject, because his family all spoke Welsh. Unfortunately, I don't. I was, you know, brought up in Britain, in England, so I haven't learned Welsh. But I know that my ancestors were treated like serfs by most of the English aristocracy. And what's happening at the moment is, like, politically correct culture has meant that people like the Welsh, the Scots, and the Irish are quite happy with their identity. They know who they are. They've got a culture as the English. Because they'd had that element of power, or at least the assumed element of power, because they went out and conquered the whole, you know, not the whole globe, but, you know, a large part of, in Victorian times, the map was all painted pink where Britain had colonies and protectorates. And it's this idea of, for the English working classes, they are totally, they've never had any power either. They've always been the ones, the factory fodders or the farm workers. And it's only been a minority elite who've been able to benefit from wealth and imperialism and expansions. And I think this is what it's all down to at the moment, is that there's this sense of crisis. In Britain, we now have a devolved government. We used to have an idea of a united Britain. We've divided ourselves up. So we've got a Welsh Parliament, a Scottish Parliament. In Northern Ireland, you've got Stormont, you know, a Northern Ireland Parliament. But we don't have an English Parliament because people daren't say that, which is another factor why you get these right-wing groups starting to set up who are nationalists, because they feel that with multiculturalism, everybody, when I was saying I used to work in these groups in the 80s, I mean, everybody could get handouts. Gay teenage groups could get handouts. Irish women's groups would get handouts. If you could say, you know, the Caribbean Development Foundation would get handouts. You know, all of these groups of people who said that they were leaders of different minority groups. Multiculturalism divides people, but the one group of people who don't actually get on are the people who are linked to the groups which officially had previous power. It's like people are trying to rewrite the history books in the present. So people, for this ancestral past that their ancestors have done, they must be made to pay for it now. It doesn't wash, you know.
It doesn't. And the other the other part of that is that when somebody accepts that sort of ancestral blame, they stop being willing to claim those things that they really should claim. It shouldn't be shameful to say, yes, I'm English. It shouldn't be shameful to say, no, I don't approve of that. I don't approve of you doing drugs because I've had to suffer for it. But
yeah.
It is now. It's a big deal if you actually exercise some judgment. Oh, my gosh, you're an intolerant, bigoted racist if you actually make a judgmental statement.
Right.
But
I've just got
not
somebody
if you're on the
coming.
Left.
Yeah, I'm going to bring someone in on this conversation. There's another person who's in the queue. Would you mind if I bring someone else in as well and we can carry on talking?
No worries.
All right. I don't know who this person is, so be nice, whoever you are. If you don't, if you use bad language, I'm going to cut you up. And I hope you're a nice person. And let's bring you in. Hello. Hello? Can you hear me?
Hello. Hello. Yes, this is Shane from Political Vindication in your chat room.
Oh, hi. Right.
Hi, I wanted to just add something quickly. As we're talking in chat room about Tony Blair's sister-in-law converting to Islam, and, you know,
Yes, Lauren Booth. It's his sister. It's his wife's sister. It's his wife's half-sister. Yeah.
Well, you know, that always confounds me because
right.
I had heard from somebody years ago that Muhammad went got a glimpse of hell, and he said that women will form the majority of the people of hell.
Hanging by their breasts from the roof of hell, no less.
Very interesting. And I thought to myself, well, now that might have some effect on me converting to Islam if I was a woman here. But I went to look it up, and it was interesting, and you probably know more about it than I, but the reasons why women make up a majority of those in hell are that there's a deficiency in her intelligence. I'm reading this from an Islamic site that says there's a deficiency in her intelligence, and it's true that she cannot either pray or fast during her menses, her menstruation, and and for that reason there's a deficiency in her religious commitment. So in other words, their God creates a creature, woman, who is condemned to hell by the very form that she was created by her creator. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. It makes
well,
no sense to
yeah,
me.
It's like the weaknesses. I mean, we've had it as well in medieval Europe. I mean, most of the people who were burned as witches, you know, when there was a culture of crisis, it's interesting that when the Crusades stopped, they didn't have somebody to go and fight against. Within Europe, people started fighting against each other, and heretics started, and then, you know, people were being burned as heretics, and people who were being accused of witchcraft were being burned, and most of those were women. So, you know, I just think it's a cultural thing of people assume, because women aren't as physically strong, that they're not as mentally strong, but...
Well,
it
might be a cultural thing, and those are the
Arabic
that we
culture,
have to work through. That's like a dark street. But if your religion says it in its holy book, if it says to its people that women were created destined for hell by menstruation, how do you outrun that?
Well, I think you have to look at how it was founded. I mean, in the time of Jahiliya, the time of ignorance, you know, was the time before Muhammad, apparently, in the Arabic world. Now, we have got the series of the people who became the caliphs. After Muhammad died in 632 AD, you had, first there was Abu Bakr, who was the father of Aisha, who was 9 years old when Muhammad, I should say raped, but had sex with her, you know, his last wife. Then you had Uthman, and then you had Osman. Now, Osman, this idea, this third caliph, he was a person who, according to tradition, he only ever laughed once and he cried once. He laughed once because he remembered that in the times of pagan ignorance, the Jahiliya time, that he made an idol out of sweet pastry and then ate it. And the only time when he cried was that he remembered that when he was burying his girl daughter alive in the sand, she reached out her little hand and she wiped the dust and the sand off his beard. Because apparently, in that culture, this is, you know, according to the myths which are going around, there's little, you know, very little evidence of it, but according to Islamic tradition, when Muhammad came and did his revelations, it was customary, if you had a girl child, to bury her, because she was of no value. So if that is true, or if it was believed to be true, that that was the attitude towards women in those times, it's perhaps not that hard to understand how most of the texts of Islam do tend to treat women as inferior. You know, and then because he had lots of wives, then you get the other people who argue, oh, but he loved women, you know. I don't know, you know, I just think that, you know, yes, women have been in, you know, some of the, in religions have been treated as second class, but, I mean, in Orthodox Jewish families, the woman has a lot of power in the home, you know what I mean? Like, the husband wouldn't dare contradict the wife in the house.
Well, sure,
you know,
but in synagogue, I believe, I'm not Jewish, but I believe in synagogue, women pray separately from the men.
Yes, I mean, but also in a lot of, you know, I just think it's something to do with the, you know, the monotheistic religions. They have this base of segregation of women, you know, and, you know, women did used to have to go into confinement when they had their menses. And it wasn't just in those religions. I mean, African tribes, they've done it, you know, when a girl starts to have her first period, you know, she's put into confinement. And it was tradition in rural Britain as well, you know.
Well, sure. I think it's all through human history. I just find it curious that in Islam, it seems to be the only religion that I know of that where it is straight from the prophet, that the woman is born deformed and is headed to hell. Now, she can try to do something, but in the worth between her and man, a man, there's a definite difference. She not only inspires sin in man, but she's got to work twice as hard to get into heaven.
Well, one of the ways they can get into heaven, as it's believed by some of these wretched Palestinian women after their brats have gone and blown themselves up, is the idea that if you raise jihadists, if you raise devout Muslim males to go out and fight for Islam, or to, in a cowardly fashion, blow yourself up at a bus stop and take a load of Israelis with you, then you get these, you know, women are really happy because, you know, their son is opening a position for them in heaven.
Amazing. Well, it's been great to talk to you, and I really appreciate your show. Thank you so much.
Good. Well, keep on listening. We're here every Friday. Nice to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Goodbye. Right. Okay, now you're still there calling them, yeah. So we were talking about this idea of sharing the blame and apportioning blame, and I think this is part of our weakness, and I think that Obama is taking, you know, he's going to this idea of trying to redress balances. And I think, you know, okay, he's black, that's great, they've got a black president, they've shown that a black person can break the glass ceiling and become a president. But what he's now doing, I think, you know, people like Eric Holder, when he talks about my people, I think that's a really offensive thing to do for somebody who is meant to be the, you know, head of the Department of Justice, the Attorney General.
It is.
And then when you had the case of the new Black Panthers, who were, you know, one with a nightstick, trying to prevent people from coming to vote, you know, to intimidate them, to then not follow through with the prosecutions. This is partiality. This is like trying to invert racism and institutionalize it.
It is.
Racism should have no part of any judgments in courts of law. If somebody is intimidating voters, they're intimidating voters, they should be prosecuted, whether they're black or white or Asian or whatever race or nationality. The other aspect is the idea of Eric Holder has been, you've got laws in Alabama they're trying to introduce, you had the laws in Arizona, the SB 1070 law of trying to prevent... which was basically, all it said was, if somebody was arrested for a potential crime, already being arrested, already being seen as a criminal, for them to, the police to ask them what their immigration status was. And they sent, you know, Holder, you know, and Obama were furious. They obliterated that.
Right.
Now, Alabama and Georgia are having the same problems. They're trying to introduce these checks and balances. Obama doesn't want these illegal immigrants to remain illegal. He wants them made citizens when they have broken the law. That's wrong.
It is wrong. And, I mean, then you have to look at Project Gunrunner.
Yes.
Heinous.
Now, to anybody who is listening who doesn't understand, Project Gunrunner was the idea of you tag weaponry, you let people buy weaponry in the United States and then take it down into Mexico to then see where it goes. I mean, it's basically encouraging murders.
Well, that's a very nice way of putting it, Adrian. the way I've been reading it, the articles I've been reading have said that those guns were actually targeted to be sold to the drug cartels in Mexico.
Yes, to then see where they went.
And that's why I believe Mexico is very upset and regarding it as sort of the United States attempting to incite civil war, because the problem is so bad down there. And the Mr. Holder's Justice Department is not cooperating with the committee that's investigating it.
Yes.
So it's just horrible.
Yeah. We've only got now 3 minutes and 58 seconds, 56, 55. We're running down the clock. We're getting very close to the end of the show. And I just think that it's very, very important at this moment in time that people really start trying to make their representatives accountable. This new... I really think you should. I'm going to put a link in the chat room before the show fully ends, if I can find it again.
For that, can I ask you a question?
Of course you can.
How are the people in England regarding the raise of the debt ceiling in America?
Well, we've been told all these stories about there are hobbits afoot and there are Satan. You know, we've been told it's all the fault of the evil Tea Party Republicans, basically. But also, we're being told that Obama is losing his support. He's down to 40% support, which is not looking good for the future. If the Republicans can't get a decent candidate, he'll get in again. But basically, if somebody in the Republican Party can have vision and unite the Republican Party, they will have a good stab at it. Because I think people are angry in Britain because we've already got our own financial problems caused by the European Union. And we are aware that with America going into this debt thing and creating problems economically, we're going to suffer for it too. You know, whatever little bits of shoots of recovery we thought we were going to have are not going to happen. I think there's deep resentment to what he's done.
Yes, and may I say that the hobbits among us were absolutely opposed to raising that debt ceiling.
Yes, because it's just practical. You don't live on debt and on the never-never and think you can survive forever. It's ridiculous. I'm just putting a link in it now. This is a PDF file. I'm putting that on the chat room. It's whitehouse.gov called Empowering Local Partners. It's a PDF file. And please try to download that and read it and try and see what this is going to actually do. This is, again, it's not empowering local partners. Well, it is. It's going to empower local partners. The partners are already the Muslim Brotherhood-influenced mosques and groups and so-called representative bodies. You really must be very aware and fight this and challenge it. Even the LA Times, very left-wing, is against it. So thank you for calling in. I'm going to now play us out with some music. Now I've lost my place. I can't even find the studio right. And I'm going to play a little bit of the Bumblebee song for those who asked for it.
Did you ever hear the story about the bumblebee who gave a cocktail party for his family? And when he got as high as he could be, he invaded a nudist colony. Buzz, 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 oh my, oh me. Buzz, 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 oh golly gee. Buzz, 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 oh what a spree. When the bumblebee invaded the nudist colony. Now Sister Jenny, wearing just her birthday suit, was strutting around the colony acting like she was cute. She plainly thought she was just about it until that bumblebee stung her on a big fat buzz, 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 oh my, oh me. Buzz, 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 oh golly gee. Buzz, 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 it was an awful spree when the bumblebee invaded the nudist colony. Mama Daisy, acting like a baby girl, naked is the first day she came in the world. She was walking around acting like a nut until that bumblebee stung her on a big fat buzz, 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 oh my, oh me. Buzz, 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 oh golly gee. Buzz, 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 it was an awful spree when the bumblebee invaded the nudist colony. Now Big Fat Bill was naked as he could be. He was happy to be living in the colony. Old Bill got tired and laid down in the grass. Then the bee came along and stung him on his big fat buzz, 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 oh my, oh me. Buzz, 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 oh golly gee. Buzz, 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 it was an awful spree when the bumblebee invaded the nudist colony.
Okay. Thank you very much for listening in. Yeah. You come back, Lucy. You seem to be dropped off for a while. I thought you'd gone.
I was just muted, and I was enjoying the show and checking out, keeping the board squared, but just, enjoying the show. I thank you for finishing off the show with the bumblebee song. It's my favorite.
Yeah, I think people quite like it. I mean, so it's a bit of lightness. I think, we've had too much soul-searching for the wrong reasons. There's too many very, very heavy things going on. And I think that we need to keep our spirits up and be cheerful in the face of all odds, really. I mean, we've got, in America, in Europe, in the free world, we have got a big, long struggle ahead. We've got the anniversary of 9/11 coming up, and I really do feel that this government in America and other governments around the world are trying to really push the memory of what that really represented under the floor. The fact that they are prepared to release this wretched document about dealing with partners in the community. I mean, this is the wrong way of dealing. If you're a government, you are in charge. You do not get other people to do your dirty work for you, and everybody must be obeying the law. You cannot have people running around like mavericks, thinking, well, I'm going to be representing the community and I will then be getting positions of power and influence. And then patronage follows. It's a disgusting, vile pattern that we've had in Britain. I was talking about Lord Ahmed in one of my shows. At the beginning, this man who was saying he used to walk into the Green Lane Mosque and feel this feeling of extreme peace. Now, Lord Ahmed, saying that, the Green Lane Mosque in Birmingham is incredibly extremist, you know. And it does have people who support the, if a girl after the age of 10 must wear a hijab, a headscarf, if she doesn't, hit her. You know, it's a mosque where people talk about killing infidels and throwing homosexuals off cliffs and things like that. And he became one of the first Muslim members of the House of Lords, our upper house. You know, we have got in Britain so many problems. It's really worrying to see under this current administration all of the huge mistakes that we made in Europe and Britain are now being made by your president, and I really cannot understand how he's been allowed to get away with it. You know, I mean, he's throwing the Constitution onto a bonfire of his own making. He's placed people like Elena Kagan into the Supreme Court, who she herself supports Sharia law. She is a solicitor. She has never been a judge. And all of a sudden, she's now sitting in the highest judge body in the land, the judiciary body in the land. That is wrong.
I don't even know how that was approved. And there's so many things that are connected with her. She can't make judgments on because it's a conflict of interest.
Yes, yes.
What is she doing there in the first place?
Well, you know, it's like with Sotomayor, you know. And then you have Hilda L. Solis, you know, the employment secretary, saying that, you know, she's going to support the rights of workers even if they're not legal. You know, this is... And then talking about, for the 10.8 million illegal citizens, talking about making a pathway to legality. This is... In effect, gerrymandering, which he is basically talking about. He's talking about where you already have sanctuary cities, about legitimizing the illegal immigrants. The idea of the Dream Act was this, I don't know, it was a knee-jerk sort of reaction to try and make people think, oh, the poor children, they didn't help it. They were just babies when they were brought here. Tough, you know. They should have the right to be able to apply for citizenship. But they also must be able to, you know, make sure that their parents go back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you cannot have people, other people, when they move to a country, and particularly it used to be in America, you had to swear the oath of allegiance. You know, there was a ceremony, there were a whole set of principles. You would go on a course, and then you would swear with your right hand in front of a judge that, you know, you're going to uphold the American Constitution. And you'd have understood it because you'd had a little bit of training. The oath of allegiance was all part and parcel of becoming not just a naturalized citizen, but a citizen, you know. And now to just make these people who have basically bypassed the law, not paid taxes, they may have been exploited in many cases, and I'm sure they have been. But the whole notion of these people who came into the country without going through any of the procedures which must be in place, it's disgusting. It's disgraceful for him to then think that, just like with Britain, with the Labour government, the idea of you have these people in the country who really have no, they don't want to be really part of the country. If they did, they would have gone through legitimate means. And, you know, if he gets them to be citizens, just like in Britain, it only used to take under the Labour government 1 year from arrival to become a full citizen. And you didn't even have to learn English to become a full citizen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a recent case last year of a centenarian, a woman who was, you know, 100, and she'd, you know, arrived, I don't know how many years ago, in America as an illegal immigrant, and she still hasn't learnt the language. You know, decades and decades on from being, you know, I think it was in the 50s or 60s she became an illegal immigrant. You know, it's a very, very disturbing precedent, which, you know, this president is trying. I know that George W. Bush did try to make an amnesty for illegal immigrants, but we knew, even under the time of George W. Bush, that some of those people who were going over the border, you know, the unprotected southern border, were people with links to Al-Qaeda. And we know now that there are people who have been caught, you know, who are definitely with relations to Hezbollah. You know, we have got, you know, really wake up throughout the entire West of
the border.
Yes, and because the border isn't being policed, and they have, they had a plan to have drone aircraft, not drone missiles, you know, with hellfire, you know, missiles being, you know, thrown at them. You're not drone aircraft to fire missiles, but to photograph and do surveillance on the border regions. That was all dropped. They had an electronic listening, a radar system. They dropped that too. You know, all within the beginning years of this current administration. And I think that it's very, very disturbing that he just doesn't seem to care. And he should. He's meant to be the president of his country, and he doesn't care about his own country. I just don't understand how he can be that.
Because I think it's rather on purpose.
I also think it's partly because maybe he has spent too much of his time outside of his country and listening to outside beliefs and thinking that, you know, and unfortunately because he was a kid in Indonesia, that does not give him any qualification to talk as if he's a man of the world. You know, he doesn't seem to have studied the negative aspects of what Islamism has done to countries. When he was there under Suharto's government, Suharto made a point of making it illegal for any Islamist groups to function because he knew what destructive people they would be. He butted out in the 1990s, and since then the Islamists have virtually taken over certain parts. In 1998 there was a civil war in Indonesia. Immediately after, that was under the, what's her name, Megawati, you know, she was the president then, and this civil war was between Muslims and Christians in the Moluccan Islands. It spread to places in Sulawesi. You know, and Obama has this horribly rosy-eyed view that, you know, everything's all great. And if you're nice and you talk well about Islam and you make out that Muhammad was this great person, that everything's all going to fit into place and it'll all be hunky-dory and the Muslims will love them. They won't love America. America is the great Satan. No matter what they say, you know, when they had Iran and the hostage crisis, it didn't matter what America had done that was positive in the country. It's just ideologically, because America, it stands in the minds of people. It used to stand for democracy. Democracy is the antithesis of Sharia law and Islam and the law of the 7th century barbarian prophet. Dare I say those words? Soon I won't be able to say those words because, you know, we're getting a climate of political correctness. It's having an edge to it. It's becoming like a new McCarthyism where you cannot stray off the path. And if you start to say the truth about what you really believe, then that can be used to bring you down and destroy you politically and make sure that you never get any your articles printed. You never get to have your say on radio. Peter Oborn is the editor of the Daily Telegraph. I was on a Spanish radio show, invited on to talk. He refused to share airtime with me. You know, I had become a blacklisted figure.
Mm-hmm.
And he's now the editor of, that time he was the editor of the Daily Mail. Now he's the editor of the senior conservative newspaper. You know, it's a difficult situation where political correctness, it's not even politically about, you know, left or right anymore. It's about, you know, what is flavor of the month and what isn't flavor of the month. And it, for quite a while now, for a few years, anybody who's critical of the strategic political side of Islam, because that's what I don't care about. If people want to be Muslims, that's their right. You know, go ahead, do that. You know, you have my blessings, but it's the political aspects of Islam trying to influence and change societies, you know, so that then when you've got so many kids in a school who are Muslim, all of a sudden, without people being made aware of it, all of a sudden all the kids then get fed halal meat without knowing. You know, it's things like that I find very disturbing.
Yep.
You know? I don't want to eat halal meat. I want to know that the meat that I eat has been humanely killed. I don't want to think that it's been... They don't, in halal butchers, they don't allow them to be stunned with an electric shock. If they were stunned first, it wouldn't be so inhumane. But they're not allowed to. They say, no, 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 that wasn't around in the 7th century. We won't do that. I'm sorry, no. And so you're actually then becoming party to animal cruelty. I mean, I love eating meat and chicken, you know, and things like that. But I want to know that the meat that I eat has been stunned electronically if it's going to be having its throat cut and having itself bled to death. But if that animal is going to have its throat cut with no anesthetic and just allowed to be drained out of its life.
Yeah.
That's cruel.
Very much aware.
Wanna...
It is cruel because it's very much aware of what's happening to it, and it can't.
Well, I've seen those beheading videos, which is the same, you know, where people get their throats cut and that look of panic in their eyes.
It's like sawed with a dull knife, with a like almost a butter knife. It's awful. It's vile.
And the look of panic, that look of, you know, horror and confusion, you know, on their faces. And these are humans, you know. An animal shouldn't have to go through that either, right? You know, I'm quite happy to eat meat. You know, I have nothing against eating meat, but I do want to know that it's been humanely dealt with. And we've got, as soon as Ramadan is over, we're going to have mass butchery where people are going to be, you know, exercising an orgy of violence. They'll buy goats around the world, and they're going to have people hacking at these poor creatures' necks. And with kids watching and seeing the barbarism,
in some cases, there will be kids participating.
I mean, what other society is expected to try and revert itself backwards in time? You know, and I think that's, I mean, there are things that, maybe I will next week make Winston Churchill part of my discourse. I wanted to talk about the Uyghurs, you know, in China, you know, the Muslims in China, there's been, you know, violence going on. And I never got to talk about what I wanted to talk about before was the Caribbean Jihad of the Jamaati Muslimin Party in Trinidad. You know, in 1990 they had a coup and took over the government and killed 20 people and never got punished for it, you know. We have these sort of these incursions against democracy all the time, and so many people think that white middle class people who think that I'm educated, and they really believe that, well, perhaps it is right to redress the balance. Okay, you want to redress the balance? Do it politically, do it through the ballot box. Don't do it through the back door. You know, but what they have been doing, the politically correct elites have been making it that people cannot now say anything which doesn't conform to this strange little twisted narrative where white people were evil terrorists. But it's all right if you're a Palestinian terrorist because you're entitled to do it. I mean, what damned hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Anyway, you want to? I think, you know, I'm getting thirsty. I didn't have my tea. I had one mug of tea for the whole show, and I've been just talking for 2 hours, and more than 2 hours almost now. It's like 2 hours and 20 minutes, and one cup of tea. I mean, that normally lasts me 20 minutes.
You need some refreshments, don't you?
Definitely. You know, but when I put the kettle on, it makes such a noise. I'm just scared that it just comes in and, you know, breaks up on the show. But, no, I mean, I rambled a bit. I mean, I didn't actually stick to a script because I just don't think I can do it. I can't stick to a script too easily.
Because when you do that, you get, you know, you start getting monotone, and so it's fine. People are engaged. They were interested, and, you know, you just try to keep them on their toes because they're not, you know, it breaks up the thought process, and they're not.
Well, I'm going to think of what should we play to sort of play out with. What do you want to listen to?
I got my bumblebee song. I'm happy.
Okay. If you had your bumblebee song, I've got a news report about a bus bombing from 2005. I don't think I'm going to go. What about those big-eyed women? That's quite a nice one. But. Sorry, I'm into the sleazy stuff tonight.
It's been fun.
Okay, I'm going to play one last slightly sleazy one, and now it's just gone out of... I can't find it now. Sorry, I'm going to go back up and find it. It slipped. I had it right in the path. Oh, I've got two sleazy ones I'd like to play, but I didn't play one. Sorry about this. Yeah, with one steady roll. My daddy rocks me. Oops, don't go down. It's not very helpful, this. Right. Okay, do you want to say goodbye, Reese? And was there anything you want to sort of add or anything?
No, I'm going to bug out and I'm going to grab something to drink because I'm feeling rather parched myself. And
okay.
You have a good one and it's been a joy, hon.
Okay, well, thank you, everybody who's managed to be listening. If you're hearing me now, you will obviously be listening to the archived version. And the longer that I carry on talking, then the longer it will be before it becomes archived. And you're able to put it onto your blogs and listen to it. And thank you very much. I've got indigestion now because I've been wanting my tea. And... thank you very much for listening. I've been Adrian Morgan. I'm the editor of Family Security Matters. I'm going to be away from Family Security Matters next week, but I'm still going to be doing the show next Friday, 6 o'clock Eastern Time. This is Radio Jihad Global Security Matters. Now, my co-host is Reese Cup. So do you want to say one last goodbye to the people?
Hey, good night and have a great week.
Yep. And that's from me too. So thank you very much for listening. This is With One Steady Roll. I think. I just think that I've just clicked something else.
Uh-oh.
No, it's playing.
There you go.
Yeah.
No. Yes. Come and rock me with one steady roll. It makes no difference if he's hot or cold. Look at the clock. I got one. I said, honey, all have fun. But you're rocking me with one steady roll. Don't be rocking me with one steady roll. Oh, it make no difference if he's hot or cold. Look at the clock. I'm about to. I said, baby, you're done, but you're rocking me with one steady roll. Yes. Oh. You're riding me. We run steady roll. No, my baby's rocking me. We run steady roll. Makes no difference if he's hot or cold. Oh, I look at the clock. The clock struck 3. Damn, you are killing me. But you're running me. We want me steady roll.
Now, yeah, what you put
it? Right there. Look at 7 o'clock. Struck 4. Oh, baby. Oh, baby. Oh,
no. Let's have some more.
Oh. But, Daddy, Daddy, you're rocking me. We've won. Oh, 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 we've won. Daddy, roll.
Thank you very much for listening. This has been Global Security Matters at Friday, the 5th of August at 6 o'clock when we started Eastern Time. My name's Adrian Morgan, and thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week, Friday, same time, same channel, Radio Jihad, Global Security Matters at 6 o'clock Eastern Time. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you next week. Please be there. Please listen. Always willing to have guests coming in and talk to us as well. Thank you very much indeed. Good night.